we inform.
Religious freedom is about people of faith being able to live out their faith, live out their convictions, no matter where they are.
We equip.
Sacred honor is the courage to speak truth, to live out your free speech.
We also rejoice in our sufferings because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance, character, and character, hope.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome to The Core. It's another edition of the program. I'm Walker Wildman here on American Family Radio. Glad to have you with us today on the program, as we appreciate you joining us each and every day. Once again, you're listening to American Family Radio. We broadcast on over 170 signals around the country that we own and operate. And then our online presence and app presence is there as well if you want to go to AFR.net or download the AFR app. Speaking of the internet, our podcast is available each and every day. So we upload the show in the form of a podcast each and every afternoon, and you can subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts, and the audio file will be queued up in your library, whatever platform you use to listen to podcasts. Just type in the name of the show, At the Core, and you can click the subscribe button, and we would love to have you subscribed to the podcast. It really helps us out with our numbers, and it also helps out with the algorithms. The more people that subscribe, the more people that listen, the more engagement, the better the show will do when people are searching for similar content. So At the Core podcast, wherever you listen to podcasts. Psalm 137 is where we are this week, reading a couple verses in here. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down and wept, where we remembered Zion. Upon the willows in the midst of it, we hung our harps. For there our captors demanded us songs, and our tormentors mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. So here we have the people of Israel in captivity in a foreign land with their captors demanding that a song be sung to them. And the Israelites are in a position of desperation, of sadness, of despair. And the last thing they want to do is sing a song to their enemies. And so that's what the context of this psalm is. But what I pointed out earlier in the week is that this is a very human experience that the people of Israel are having here. They're in captivity. This is a very human experience where they don't want to sing a song to their captors. I mean, the last thing they want to do is try to come up with a song of joy and rejoicing when they're not in a state of joy and rejoicing. So, as you know, believers today, we can sympathize with this place of sadness and despair that the people of Israel were in at the time. But they go on to talk about their hope being in the Lord. And but grieving is biblical. When you look throughout Scripture, you know, there's this passage, there's passages of Jesus being sorrowful and weeping and being emotional. Job, man, you read what Job went through. Emotions are, God created us humans with to have emotions, and being sorrowful, there's a time and a place for that. Scripture says, weep with those who weep, mourn with those who mourn, and rejoice with those who rejoice. So some people try to, you know, develop this robot mentality of we can't have emotions and we all need to be analytical and let's just use our head here. And there's a time and a place for that as well. But don't discount the human factor that we are all created with emotions, and we need to learn how to process those in a biblical manner. Well, a few housekeeping items I want to mention, some exciting opportunities coming up to engage with AFA and to further the vision and the work here of AFA. The first thing I want to mention as we wrap up this week is our Operation Christmas Child Partnership. This is an excellent project. We've been working on this for several years, probably a couple of decades, of promoting the shoeboxes with Operation Christmas Child and Samaritan's Purse. So this is National Collection Week. The 25th is the last day to turn in your shoebox. There's over 4,700 drop-off locations in all 50 states. So statistically speaking, there's a drop-off location near you. And that's probably the case for the vast majority of people, unless you live in some remote area. But National Collection Week is this week, and we would encourage you to pack a shoebox and deliver it to your church or a drop-off location. If you want to learn more about some last-minute items with this, you can go to samaritanspurse.org/OCC, samaritanspurse.org/OCC. And if you just haven't had time or for some other reason are unable to pack a shoebox yourself, if you go to samaritanspurse.org/OCC, you can actually pack a shoebox on their website. So you can donate a certain amount to Samaritan's Purse and build your own shoebox online. And then Samaritan's Purse will pack the shoebox for you, basically. You can build the box online and donate, and then Samaritan's Purse will see that through the finish line. Samaritanspurse.org for more information. Our Activate Summit, our first ever Activate Summit, is coming up this summer, June 12th through the 14th. No, I'm not a keynote speaker, and I'm not upset about that either. I will be on, I believe, a panel discussion. But we're going to have Abraham Hamilton III of the Hamilton Corner. We're going to have Dr. Frank Turek and Ed Vitagliano and several other speakers. Todd Herman, by the way, from a disciple's view, all of them and others are going to be at our Activate Summit 2025, June 12 through 14. June 12 through 14. Our theme is Biblical Bedrock, Building on the Authority of Scripture. Activate.afa.net is that URL. Activate.afa.net is that URL. And the last thing I'll mention, and then we'll jump into some of these clips and stories for this segment, our Israel trip in 2025 in February. I've been mentioning that we've had some slots available, some openings where there were some vacancies, and we're actually almost full. I opened up 10 slots about a week or two ago, and we've got 8 people as of today. So there's 2 slots left. Unless somebody backs out, there's 2 slots left. So thank you for those who've decided to go with us. You can go over to wildmangroup.com and check out the Holy Land page there, wildmangroup.com. So we're looking forward to going, and my disclaimer, and I'll probably say this until President Trump gets in there and things settle down over there, but if you're uncomfortable with traveling to Israel, if you don't understand the risk involved, if you're hesitant for safety reasons, then you just don't need to go. It's best that you just don't go and you wait, Lord willing, until another opportunity in future years, because we're going to keep going. We've been doing this for nearly 30 years, my dad and mom have. So, but those of you who understand the environment over there, you understand that there are risks with traveling to Israel, just like there are risks with traveling anywhere, in particular, especially in that region of the world. Those who've, you know, looked at the risk, they know the information, they know what's involved with traveling to the Middle East and Israel, we would love for you to join us. So we've got a few spots left over at wildmangroup.com. Well, it's been a busy few weeks with President Trump's transition in full gear. He's been nominating people left and right to these various cabinet positions and other executive branch positions. One of the positions is the Energy Secretary, and the gentleman's name is Chris Wright. Chris Wright, he's the Energy Secretary nominee for the Department of Energy, which is a cabinet-level position under President Trump's incoming administration. But look, I don't know this guy personally, Chris Wright, but he looks like the real deal. And he hangs out with people that I like. One of the conferences he was speaking at this past year was I think it was a national conservatism conference where they were talking about domestic policy and what it means to make America secure, prosperous, free. And listen to him debunking the climate change hoax. Clip one.
So energy matters. It matters for human lives. It matters for human well-being. It matters for low-income people and social mobility, low-income people to come up. When you hear crazy stuff today, check it out, dig a little deeper. Hurricanes are not growing. That's in the IPCC report. Tornadoes are actually on the decline. Floods, droughts, all of these things you hear ceaselessly, they just simply aren't so. It isn't even controversial that they're not so. But media, politicians just continually abuse these facts. And I'll end with one last fact, because anxiety is growing among kids. I'm sure everyone has seen that. 20% of kids go to bed at night worried about climate change. Your chance of dying from extreme weather today is greater than 95, has been reduced by more than 97% over the last century. There's just an absolute plummeting from 500,000 people a year dying from extreme weather to less than 10,000 the last couple years, while the world population has quadrupled. So facts matter, human liberty matters, bottom-up social organization has always been the way to a better world. Let's resist this force of top-down control that's not benefiting humans except those in government.
So that was Energy Secretary nominee Chris Wright, and he's a former energy executive, current actually, assuming he keeps that position in the private sector, which he'll probably have to step down because of his role at the Department of Energy. But nonetheless, he's been in business. He's been in the energy sector for a long time, but he hasn't bought into this climate change mania. And that's exactly what it is. And we've been talking about it on the show for a long time. But this climate change agenda is not only is it built on a falsehood, but it's basically become a religion. It's basically become a religion in and of itself. And it's all built on falsehoods. I mean, when you start looking at their assumptions, they're way off. They're way off. And what I'm talking about is that the underlying premise that you and I driving our vehicles down the road is causing the planet to heat, to warm, and drastically change the environment that we live in because we're emitting fossil fuels. And this theory has been going on a long time. It was being taught to me when I was in public education. And they shifted at some point over the last, I don't know, probably 15 to 20 years, they shifted from global warming to climate change because the globe stopped warming. And if you look throughout human history, there are different periods of warming and cooling that our Earth goes through. And so for some periods, for maybe, let's say, a century, the Earth begins to warm. And then for the next century, the Earth begins to cool and so on and so forth. And so it's basically this cyclical type effect of our planet that God created. But the so-called scientists started looking into this, and they were just saying, wow, humans are just causing the planet to heat up. Well, actually, wasn't the case. Our planet was actually just going through a normal cycle of warming, and then now it's actually going through a cycle of cooling and back and forth, but it's not man-made. And so the science is very, very spotty on this, such that there is any true science on it. And Chris Wright is just pointing out the fact that energy is a positive thing, that fossil fuels are a good thing. I mean, think about all of the good for humanity that has arisen out of energy production, whether it's electricity or, diesel and gasoline and all other forms of energy, natural gas, oil. I mean, this has been an absolute blessing to mankind. Not a curse, a blessing to mankind. And so instead of recognizing the God-given gift of fossil fuels, all the seculars want to do is say that it's evil and it's bad, and we need to go back to the Stone Ages. We'll be back in a few.
At the Core podcast are available at AFR.net. Now, back to At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to the second segment of today's program. Walker Wildman here with you on At the Core here on American Family Radio. Well, as we do each week, we like to bring in different guests from different backgrounds and different areas of expertise to talk about the core values that here as Christians, as believers, we care about. And one of those issues that we talk about frequently is human life and the sanctity of human life and how both babies in the womb and then, you know, even outside of the womb as well, all the way up until, you know, you pass from this earth, that human life should be sacred. It should be fostered. It should be protected. And we've really lost a sense of that here in America. And abortion is just one of the ways that we see how life has been devalued. Well, joining us now is Kelsey Pritchard. She's Director of State Public Affairs at the Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America Organization. Kelsey's with us now. Kelsey, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Walker.
Well, Kelsey, one thing that we've seen over the last 2 years is since the overturning of Roe v. Wade, which was a monumental victory for the life movement, ever since that, it came with some risk from a legal standpoint, because when the Supreme Court said, "Hey, you know, we're just going to let the states duke this out," of course, it undoubtedly permitted very liberal states to do some very bad things when it comes to the abortion issue. And one of those things has been this ballot initiative process where the abortion issue has been taken directly to the popular vote through this ballot amendment or ballot initiative process. And it's really hurt our movement because I believe we were in some regard caught flat-footed. But bring us up to date on your assessment of where we've come since the overturning of Roe v. Wade.
Yeah, I mean, we are at a number of states that have a pro-life protection in place. That number is over 20 that have a pro-life law that protects babies at some point. But you're right, the Dobbs victory, it really opened up a lot of other things, and these ballot measure fights have been a major challenge. Now, thankfully, this year we won our first ballot measure fight since the Dobbs victory, and we won in Florida and South Dakota and Nebraska, and those were huge wins. And because we won there, we preserved the laws that protect more than 51,000 lives annually. So those victories are huge, not even just for those states, but for moving forward. We now have a blueprint, and we know how we beat these ballot measures, and we can apply those lessons in future fights, and we hope to win more of them.
Let me ask you this, Kelsey, and this, I'm not sure if you guys are looking into this or not, but I've talked to several people that are pretty deep into politics and policy and the pro-life movement, and it's become clear that this ballot amendment process just isn't working out for our side. I mean, there's also questions about, do you want to just take every controversial issue in our culture to a popular vote as opposed to using representative democracy, which our founding fathers intended? So there's that aspect. But overall, I mean, this ballot amendment process has become a weapon of the left over the last few years. What's y'all's opinion of that? I mean, have y'all really taken a side on that as far as we need these ballot amendment processes anymore? What's y'all's thoughts on that?
You know, I think, well, the reason we won in Florida, but one of the reasons we won was that they had a 60% threshold. And I think that's mm-hmm. a very important thing for constitutional amendments. It's not just a law that you're changing, it's your constitution that's permanent. And so I think something like that is very wise to have in place for states. Unfortunately, I think some efforts in the states for ballot measure reform, those are uphill climbs and haven't always been successful. And so I think sometimes we just have to look at how we work with what's in front of us and the processes that are already in place. And I think what happened in Nebraska is very interesting and something for us to consider in other states, because when the pro-abortion lobby brought an amendment, you know, your typical amendment that you see in other states that's going to allow abortion in all 9 months, it's going to take away parental rights, it's going to do all these horrible things, we had U.S. Senator Pete Ricketts and the pro-life movement come forward with an alternative. And they brought a 12-week measure that mirrored their pro-life law that would not allow abortion in the second and third trimesters. It would also allow the legislature to protect life sooner if they pass a new law. And that was successful over the pro-abortion amendment. And so I think we do need to take a look at each state individually, consider this win in Nebraska, how the lessons of that can be applied. But we know that overall, if we're going to be victorious in these ballot measures, it has to come down to GOP involvement. We won in Nebraska because U.S. Senator Ricketts was involved. We won in Florida because Governor Ron DeSantis was a champion. We won in South Dakota because Republicans there were engaged. So it all comes down to the GOP being involved, and that's going to make or break us in these amendment fights going forward.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it was disappointing to see some Republican lawmakers try to stay out of this fight. I think it's a big mistake, not just from a principled standpoint, but practically speaking as well. I mean, the Democrats are so radical on this issue that it's low-hanging fruit for Republicans to just step out and speak up about the truth of protecting innocent life at all stages. Once again, we're talking to Kelsey Pritchard. She's with the Susan B. Anthony List, or SBA Pro-Life America. Let me ask you about the money side of this, because it's no secret that the left has been outspending our movement for a long time, not just in the pro-life area, but other areas as well. That used to be kind of a negative, and our movements for a long time kind of moaned and groaned about how we don't have $1 billion to spend on our issues. But Kelsey, I'm beginning to think that the money's really not all that it's made out to be, because when you look at how much money, for example, was put against President Trump, over $1 billion was put against President Trump, and he still won by a wide margin. And then you look at Florida and see how the life movement was outspent about 10-1 in Florida, but yet you still defeated that pro-abortion ballot amendment. It's clear that there's other ways to advance life other than just having the most money.
Yeah, that's right. And I will say money is important. You have to have enough money to go on offense, and so you're not just playing defense all the time. And you have to have enough money to do the basic things that a campaign does. But it's not everything. We were outfunded, I think it was 10-1 in Florida. They raised $118 million for this pro-abortion ballot measure, and that wasn't enough. And they even have, of course, had the legacy media painting Ron DeSantis as a dictator, and they couldn't take him down. They couldn't win it, even with all of that money and all of that force of the media and Hollywood and everyone else and the parts of our society that are now pro-abortion pushing this upon people. And so it all comes down to messaging. It all comes down to who's involved, and it comes down to who's going to step forward in the GOP and be a champion. Because when our side is able to make the case and we can actually reach people with our message through the platforms that Ron DeSantis and GOP leaders have, that's how we win. That's how we resonate. And, you know, if it was an equal fight, funding was equal and everything else was equal, we didn't win every time. And that's how we won in South Dakota. The pro-life side actually raised more money than the pro-abortion side in South Dakota, and only 40% of voters voted for that ballot measure. And so, of course, it's an important thing, but it's not everything. We can win just like Florida won.
Absolutely. And we're going to have to continue to be diligent on this, because we got a lot, our movement has a lot of ground to make up with some of these ballot amendments. And you know, we need to utilize the tools. I like what you said about how they, one of these states, I think it was South Dakota, not only did the Republican senator get involved, but also Nebraska, that is, but also introducing a counter amendment that really kind of muddies the waters to such a degree that people are like, look, I'm just not voting for either one of these because I'm good with the status quo. But I also think we do need to seriously look at the amendment process broadly, and when possible, up it to 60%. I think 60% is a good threshold. I honestly don't know why we ever in these states did 50% or 51%, because to your point, we have a state legislature for a reason. We have a governor for a reason. Why are we doing this direct democracy 51% thing on issues that are so consequential and that go into the state constitution? So I'm hoping we'll continue to kind of scrutinize these ballot amendment processes. But last few minutes that we have here, what's some challenges that you would give to our audience as far as how to prepare for these fights over the sanctity of life as we move ahead?
Yeah, I mean, we're already looking to the midterms, right? It hasn't even been a few weeks since the election. We're already looking at the next one. We're looking at the next presidential election, of course, and trying to get involved with that. I think the most important thing that we can do, that our movement can do right now, is to be talking to the people on our own side and be talking to GOP officials. Because unfortunately, what we've seen since the Dobbs decision is some Republicans try to run away from the life issue. And they, you know, they were very pro-life and for unborn children's rights until the day that our state and federal lawmakers had the ability to enact legislation to protect life. And so we need to encourage them to stand firm on this. And they've been told, a lot of them by consultants, that it's not a good issue politically and you need to stay away from it. It's a Democrat issue. That is the complete wrong thing to do. And that's how you lose on the issue. That's how you lose an election, is if you bury your head in the sand and pretend like it doesn't exist, because the Democrats are going to mischaracterize you. Mm-hmm. And they're going to, you know, talk about your position in the wrong way. And Republicans need to be out there exposing that the Democrats don't want any limits on abortion whatsoever. That is their official position. They have adopted the abortion industry's position. And we need to explain how we contrast our position with that and how our position is the compassionate one. It's not only compassionate for the unborn child who can feel pain at 15 weeks and has a heartbeat at 6 weeks, but it's also compassionate for the women and for people who have unplanned pregnancies. And we're the movement that comes alongside women. We're the movement of pregnancy centers that are the hands and feet when someone has an unexpected pregnancy, and they come alongside those women when they're pregnant and after their child is born to support them.
Yeah, absolutely. And to your point about it being compassionate, obviously for the life of the child, but for the mother as well, the trauma that follows an abortion is often overlooked, not talked about, but we've aired special programs here on our network that give testimonies of women who've been harmed by abortion. And it's devastating. It's devastating. So that needs to be highlighted as well. I know the media is not going to cover it, but we can when able. Hey, Kelsey, thanks so much for coming on. I appreciate the work of SBA.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. God bless, Walker.
All right. Thank you so much. That's Kelsey Pritchard. She's Director of State Public Affairs for SBA Pro-Life America, the Susan B. Anthony list, that is. And just kind of giving us a lay of the land of where we are in all these states with these ballot amendments and the work that has to be done. The good news, to her point, is that we defeated three of them. So we were having a 100% losing record before November 5th, and thankfully we defeated three of them. So I think the momentum is beginning to shift, and we can begin really peeling back at these dangerous ballot amendment processes around the country. Another thing I wanted to mention in this segment is the nominations that President Trump is putting forth. As of Thursday afternoon, Representative Matt Gaetz, the Attorney General nominee, actually withdrew his nomination on Thursday of this week. So that was an interesting development. I knew there was a lot of criticism out there for Matt Gaetz, but I thought he would probably weather the storm and make it through Senate confirmation with probably a slim majority. But nonetheless, Representative Gaetz has withdrawn. I don't know the ins and outs of that. So President Trump is on the search again for a future nominee. I'll tell you who would be a good one, and who I've always liked, is Attorney General Ken Paxton out of the state of Texas. Attorney General Ken Paxton is just a rock star. I mean, remember, he has been fighting back against the Biden regime for 4 years. He fought against, he also fought against the election integrity issue. And I'll just recall this fight we had over election integrity. In 2021, In late 2020, early 2021, when no judge would hardly take up the question of election integrity, and they would come up with all these excuses about how there's no standing, no one's been harmed, et cetera, et cetera. Attorney General Ken Paxton was the only state attorney general that appealed the election integrity issue directly to the Supreme Court. He was the only one that put his neck out and raised the question with the Supreme Court, basically about, you know, equal protection. And it wasn't the equal protection clause, but it was a similar constitutional question about, hey, one state's doing it this way and Texas is doing it this way, and the votes of Texans is being discounted because, for example, over here in Pennsylvania, they're doing it this way and they're cheating and they're not counting votes correctly. And so we need to have this thing leveled out to where all things are equal and we're all in the same playing field. That was a fundamental question before the Supreme Court. But that was a very risky move. I mean, there was a lot of criticism about anyone daring to question the election results. I mean, they called them insurrectionists, election deniers, and all the other names in the book that they could come up with. But Attorney General Ken Paxton out of Texas, I mean, he just stood up and fought for that issue, and he's been doing that for a long, long time. He's also been very pro-life. He's gone after abortion providers in Texas who are breaking the law. He's gone after the pornography industry in order to protect children. I mean, I could just go on and on. He's been good on the border at prosecuting cartels and others. So Attorney General Ken Paxton from Texas would be an excellent pick as Attorney General for the United States. And there's several others that come to mind from various states. Attorneys General that would be good picks for USAG. But President Trump, look, he needs a fighter. He needs a disruptor. And there was a lot of that that Matt Gaetz was going to do. So our hope, our desire is that President Trump picks a disruptor for this Attorney General position, because there is so much corruption. There's so much wrong with the DOJ and the FBI that they're going to have to clean house. They're going to absolutely clean house in order to restore those agencies to what they should be and how they should operate for the American people. We'll be back in a few.
At the Core podcast are available at AFR.net. Now, back to At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to The Core here on American Family Radio. Walker Wildman here with you. Chris Woodward in with us from American Family News, AFN.net. Hey, Chris, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Well, there's so much to talk about, Chris, but you know I always like to talk about the economy. Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk about more than the economy. We've got some excellent stories from the Media Research Center and other things regarding the President Trump's transition. But nonetheless, let's talk about the housing market. There was some good sentiment that we saw post-election, but there's a lot of ground to make up on home building.
Yes. One example here is from MarketWatch. The headline is, new home construction falls to three-month low as high rates and hurricanes impact builders. Construction fell further than expected. I know I have said this before, so if you're a longtime listener, and thank you for that, you've probably heard me talk about how if we're not building things, that means things are not being made. That means all kinds of people are not making as much money as they could be. It's more than just construction workers that are impacted when there's bad construction news, which is why people like Dan Cilio would always take a long time to go over construction numbers when it comes to economic news and jobs reports.
So the home building is very important for multiple reasons, but inventory seems like this never-ending problem, right? I mean, we could have probably came on AFR or listened to AFR 10 years ago, 20 years ago, and inventory was going to be mentioned as a problem. And in order to fix that, you're going to have mass production of homes, and you can't have mass production of homes if there's economic instability. And that's what we've been seeing from time to time is every few years, something economically happens and builders get skittish and then they stop building houses and we really get set back. So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, there's a couple of things here. It's kind of a tale of two candidates. Kamala Harris promised to do things to build all kinds of homes, but she was going to use government funding to help do those kinds of things on top of her promise of giving people $25,000 to put towards the price of a home. Those things are not going to work because all of a sudden it's just going to make people increase the price of a home $25,000, knowing they're going to get at least $25,000. And then government spending to increase the number of houses out there is only going to cause more problems. Whereas Donald Trump comes in and campaigns, hey, I'm going to get government out of the way. We're going to cut all kinds of regulations that are going to make things cheaper for you. And that's why you have people like Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy saying, yes, we're going to get really into a lot of executive branch regulations. We're going to get government out of the way. This is going to help you in your pocketbook. And all of a sudden, in maybe a year or two from now, you're seeing better affordable prices when it comes to buying a home.
Yeah. Mortgage rates are, I mean, you would think they just got to come down. And people I talk to say, well, they're not going to go back down to pre-COVID levels. And I'm not saying they will or they won't. I don't know. I've learned to never say never.
Right. Yeah.
But there's going to be some relief there.
Right.
And on the pricing front too, both things, the interest rates and pricing are going to have to come down.
Yeah. I mean, we've seen worse housing rates in not too distant American history. But the thing that people need to realize here is we're paying a lot more for meat and milk and bread and all these other things.
And the actual homes.
Right.
You know?
So there's a whole bunch of other factors that are at play here when most people are living on a credit card and have been for a few years now.
That's my response to boomers that say, oh, don't complain. I had an 18% mortgage rate when I got married.
Right. How much was the home you bought?
Yeah, and I go, yes, you're correct on that point. But how much do you pay for that home that's 2,000 square feet? Oh, I built the house for $30,000. And I'm like, that's the problem, because we're paying $300,000 now for the same house.
Yes, and in that neighborhood that you moved out of to retire to or whatever, that 40-year-old home is now a ridiculous amount of money here.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, we do have a housing shortage. There are a lot of people coming into the U.S. People, the population is growing. These people need somewhere to live. But it's a question of how do we fix it? Do you want government to do things when government oftentimes makes prices worse?
Yeah.
Or do you want government to get out of the way and let the private sector do a better job?
Well, and here's one thing we've really got to combat, and this is just my personal opinion. It isn't necessarily thus says the Lord, although I could probably make a strong biblical case for this. But homeownership has to be cool again. This whole renting thing has been a fad in the last decade or two. And it is long term, it is bad for these people that do not invest in a home.
Yes.
Homeownership is one of the hallmark ways to build wealth in America, because it's a hard asset, it appreciates, and eventually by retirement age, Lord willing, you pay it off. And then your children are blessed with that asset, you know, when you pass away into eternity. But we gotta, you know, preach that, because everybody just wants to rent, and there's a time and a place for renting, but eventually people need to have the goal of home ownership.
Yeah, I saw an article in the last week or so. It talked about how a growing number of young people were, because they're working more remotely, have started to just go on vacations without their bosses or supervisors knowing about it. So you might go to Boston and spend a couple of weeks while you're working remotely from the hotel room and all these kinds of things, whereas you could be paying for a house that is going to help you later, and it's going to provide you a lot more space than some closet you're going to rent in Manhattan or wherever it may be.
Yeah, and you look at how much money you're putting towards renting if you add it up like over a lifetime. Wow. And at the end, you don't own anything.
You might as well throw it in a garbage can and light it on fire.
Yes.
Because that's about the same thing.
Yeah. So homeownership needs to be cool again. And that's really a lesson of, you know, financial stewardship and planning. But Americans, Chris, we're not out of the water yet. We're not out of the woods yet, rather, on the financial hardships of the Biden administration, because people are feeling a little more optimistic. Hey, Trump's going to come in and save the day. And that's true to a degree. He's going to get gas prices down. Mark my word, it's going to go below $2. He's going to do it. And it's going to defy the odds of all the analysts that said, oil will never go below $80 a barrel. Well, it's about to. Get ready. But the credit card debt that people have accumulated to compensate from Biden's disaster, dumpster fire administration, we got some ground to make up.
Yeah, while we're teaching young people especially that homeownership needs to be cool again, you also need to be talking with people of various generations why it's important to get out of credit card debt.
Yeah.
It seems like we never really learn our lesson. We should. Like, you know, people that lived through the 70s and 80s, that went through, you know, counting change to be able to buy some gas, they didn't necessarily learn their lesson and then save from henceforth. And then all of a sudden you had economic problems, you know, the 2008, 2009 situation that carried over from Bush into Obama.
Being over-leveraged on, you know,
inventory. We should have learned there, and we didn't. And really, you should learn from this particular terrible, no good, very bad situation. And at some point, things do need to change. We do, as a society, need to realize, hey, we need to really start paying debt down. We need to make sure we have a lot of stuff socked away in the event, God forbid, I lose my job or something.
Yeah.
Because if we don't, it's just going to be the same stuff 10, 15, 20 years from now, and we're talking about that.
Yeah. Yeah, and I would say, you know, some of the excuses, and then we'll move on, some of the excuses of, you know, why Washington spends so much money is they say, well, I mean, the voters, you know, they don't really care about this issue of financial stewardship, and they're good with the debt, so we're good with the debt. That's not necessarily the case. I mean, consumers, don't get me wrong, consumer debt is a problem. But I'll guarantee you, if you run the polls on whether people approve of $37 trillion, it's going to be an absolute no.
Right.
Because even people who have some form of debt understand that there's a limit on what's wise to get into when it comes to debt and getting over leverage. And $37 trillion, my friend, I bet 95%+ of voters would say, hey, that's a bad idea, my friend, to go into $37 trillion in debt.
Yes. I mean, we're going to be at $40 trillion really soon unless somebody, unless something like Musk and Ramaswamy actually have a positive impact there and they make government smaller, which makes it cheaper, and then we actually start to pay down things. Meanwhile, voters really need to hold politicians' feet to the fire because they often promise they're going to cut spending, they're going to be more economical and all these things. And really, the problem with Washington is it has for a very long time, even when it's been in Republican hands, it just it spends willy-nilly because it's on an endless fund of an endless source of money.
Yeah.
Like, we the people are forced to pay taxes that they then take from us and put towards all sorts of
and
projects
then they print
we don't
money.
Agree with.
And then they print money. So they act like they need our money, but then they can print however much they need.
Yes.
So it's like, why don't we pay taxes? Why don't we just print all the money we need?
Well, or they'll put it in some gigantic bill that no one reads.
Yeah.
And then when they're, you know, well, why are you voting for this senator? Why are you voting for this representative? Well, you know, on page 3096, it says we're going to not buy shoes for soldiers, and I can't vote that way.
Yeah, that's a good point. What about this? You got this report on the complete ignoring, mostly ignoring of the Lake and Riley case.
Yes, this is a disgrace to the news profession, of which I am a proud member of. But Newsbusters did a story this week, a study, I should say, and it determined that broadcast TV networks ABC, CBS, and NBC spent nearly four times more covering so-called Garbage Gate than the Lake and Riley murder trial. Garbage Gate is the term given to the frequent wall-to-wall, days-on-days coverage of that guy making the bad joke at the Trump rally in Madison Square Garden about Puerto Rico being an island of garbage. Networks lost their mind over about a five-day period on that and said, this is why we can't have Trump back in office.
Which, Chris, that was on that joke. Number one, it was a comedian. Mm-hmm. Number two, it was a joke.
Right.
So, like, you and I joke about Mississippi, right? We're like, we're last in everything except for Arkansas. They're last. If it wasn't for Arkansas, Mississippi would be last in everything.
Yes.
But can people not, like, make jokes about other people?
Not anymore.
But he made a joke about Puerto Rico, and it's like, guys, come on. Like the left has no sense of humor.
Right. We do need to make humor great again. I mean, Jerry Seinfeld and others have said, like, things we talked about on, you know, my show 30 years ago, we could not cover anymore. We would be canceled and forced to apologize.
Yeah.
You can't joke about anything anymore. But the terrible thing about this is these broadcast TV networks, which have been around for generations and are, unfortunately, the source of news for millions of Americans even today, they spent four times more airtime-wise on Garbage Gate than they did the Lake and Riley murder trial. And Curtis Alk and I, the guy that did the research for Newsbusters, we talked about why they would do this. Obviously, it's because the man convicted of killing Lake and Riley is an illegal immigrant, which is something they did not want to touch with a 10-foot pole.
Yeah, Chris, I've actually got a clip on this. So this was a factoid that I didn't know until this trial occurred, But the U.S. government funded Lakin Riley's killer's flight down to Georgia. He was in New York. He got a free flight on behalf of the taxpayer down to Georgia. Let's listen to this revelation from the trial of Lakin Riley's murderer.
Someone else that you got to know that you live with while you were here in Athens.
Alguien más que llegaste a conocer, que vivió con ustedes aquí en Athens.
Giancarlo Hernández.
Giancarlo Hernández.
And how did you get to Athens?
¿Y cómo llegaron a Athens?
Por en Nueva York pedimos en Manhattan.
In New York, we asked in Manhattan.
En el Hotel Roosevelt.
And Hotel Roofing?
Roosevelt.
Roosevelt.
De Manhattan pedimos un vuelo humanitario aquí hasta Atlanta.
In Manhattan, we requested for a humanitarian flight to come here to Atlanta.
And when was that?
¿Y cuándo fue eso?
Palo, como el de 9 a 10 de septiembre.
Around the 9th, 10th of September.
And where did you go when you arrived in Athens?
¿Y cuando llegó a Athens, a dónde fue?
Al aeropuerto Airport.
To the airport Airport.
Al aeropuerto de Atlanta.
Airport.
So the U.S. government funded in the name of humanitarian flights. By the way, Chris, why can't you and I get humanitarian flights to our final destination? But the illegal immigrant can. So it was the Biden administration that flew Lakin Riley's murderer down to Athens, Georgia.
Yes. And it was also really our government in general that failed Lakin Riley, as well as the little 12-year-old girl and a whole bunch of other people
who don't even
make the news.
Yes.
Or at least this amount of news. Our taxpayer-funded government, and I guarantee you the money that the government used to fly the convicted murderer on the humanitarian flight was probably approved for some other reason, but the government just, we'll get it back somewhere else.
Yeah, and then they want to complain and talk about how expensive is it going to be to deport illegal immigrants, but they're flying murderers around the country.
It's shameful, and that's being polite, because Colossians 3:8 won't let me use what real words I want to say right now.
Yes, I know, it's infuriating.
Not that I would, but you know what I'm saying, you know.
No, I get it. It's infuriating. I mean, it should make people angry about what's been happening to our country and the importing of these foreigners that just completely suck the blood out of our country, both economically and, in this case, you know, killed Lakin Riley. And thankfully, he was convicted at two life sentences.
Yeah, and Democrats clearly have not learned a lesson here. At least some Democrats. Governors are out there saying already, we're going to fight you, Trump, on these mass deportations.
I think that's a big mistake on their part.
That's the reason that it's one of the reasons they lost the election.
Also, the resistance, if you notice, the resistance is shrinking. Instead of 20 states resisting Trump like the first go around, there's like 8, right? And they're all left wing, you know, places that I wouldn't want to live. Let me just say that. Chris, thanks so much for coming on. All right, folks, we got an interesting 4 years with President-elect Trump coming into office, and there's going to be a lot of battles that need to take place in order to ensure that righteousness and good policies are advanced in our nation's capital and around the country. Thanks so much for joining The Core. We'll see you next time. You've heard a lot about saving babies on this show. That's because it's important to me personally. And let me just be frank with you. We need to save them. That is why we have partnered with Preborn, the nation's leader in introducing mothers with unplanned pregnancies to their babies. And once she hears the heartbeat and sees that precious life growing inside of her, she is twice as likely to choose life. Now that's a miracle. But quite honestly, if we don't save them, who will? Preborn receives no government funding, so their work is completely dependent on us. Preborn has rescued over 280,000 babies, and that's not all. They provide love, support, and counseling for up to 2 years for free, saving lives and souls. One ultrasound is just $28, or 140 helps rescue 5 babies' lives. Abortion doesn't stop, so we can't. Together, you and I can save lives. Just call #250 on your cell and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.